don't you know? We're talking about a revolution. Sounds.
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. And I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Jake Towne. Gene DiNardo is going to be joining us later on in the show, but Jake and I will be carrying you along for the first bit here. And it is Thursday, March 1st, 2012, first day of March. Is this year moving along quickly or what? Anyway, here are the headlines we're following this week. Possibilities of a brokered GOP convention. We'll be exploring that today during the show. There is some fallout from the Quran burning, not surprising, in Afghanistan at a U.S. base. North Korea says they're going to let in inspectors to inspect their nuclear facilities. Yeah, right. WikiLeaks releases stolen Stratfor emails. The European Central Bank lends out the 529 billion euro loan to 800 banks. But the story we're going to start with this week is Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke. His testimony to Congress raised some eyebrows, raised some questions, and Jake, you have some of the details about that.
I was actually able to watch most of that testimony where he pretty much gets tossed softball questions by all the Congress critters. But the very interesting that happened was during the middle of his comments, the markets, the stock markets went down about 1% or so, based on his comments that they weren't really looking at further money printing or quantitative easing or stimulus at this time. However, the precious metals market skydived, went down, gold was down about over about $100 or 5%. Silver was down 8 to 10% at one point. I went from $37 an ounce, and it was actually going up before the news hit, all the way down to about 33.5. But a lot of the other indicators, like the dollar index, did strengthen, but not by a whole lot during the day, 1%, which is normal market action. The stock market at the end of the day actually closed in the green, actually finished up. The 10-year treasury was unchanged at a ride around 2%, and copper, which is kind of a key indicator for the commodities, gold and silver, was down by 0.5%, which is also pretty insignificant. So it was very interesting to see that because, you know, one way or the other, and there's a lot of conjecture on the internet and the gold and silver circles that this was blatant market manipulation by central banks or some other third party. But I think it really kind of stands out that gold and silver are now trading as currencies because there's no other reason really for that type of thing to occur. And the disconnect from the market is also quite interesting. And the timing was also very, very coincidental, in quotation marks, because over in Europe they had all this money printing going on, the LTRO operations that we've talked about on the show before. They had the second round of that this year, and the second round was good for another $712 billion worth, or about 530 billion euros. It was given out to 800 European banks, which combined with the first round adds up to about 1.2 trillion U.S. dollars has been pumped into the system. And I think it's important to realize what's exactly going on here. The banks have lent out the depositors' money. They, for whatever reason, are not getting back enough, or they've done poor investments. And the central bank is just bailing them out by giving them cash at a 1% interest rate, which is going to be far below inflation rates, and it doesn't need to be paid back for 3 years, and even then it probably won't need to be paid back. So a very interesting day, and you know, gold and silver did bounce kind of back up today. Silver got rid of most of the losses, actually, gold is looking like it's going to take another look at the $1,800 an ounce level. But, you know, it's hard to say one thing for sure one way or the other without looking at who was actually doing the selling. But it really, really, really looked contrived.
It did look contrived. And, in fact, one of the things that is was particularly contrived in a positive way was Congressman Ron Paul, who absolutely dragged Ben Bernanke over. I'm not sure what the right metaphor is, but he dragged him out, and it basically said he was destroying the economy, essentially. He held up a silver coin and accused him of debasing the currency and destroying America's wealth. Sounds very similar to familiar to listeners of this show, because of course we've been talking about that for a few years now. But he not only accused Bernanke of it, but he wouldn't let Bernanke talk. That was one of the most interesting things. He actually asked Bernanke a question about whether or not he ever went to the supermarket. Bernanke started to answer, then Paul just kept right on going. It was almost out of character.
Right, and the silver coin that he held up, he was pointing out that it was buying more gas than it did several years ago, and kind of going back in the history since Benton Bernanke had been chairman of the Federal Reserve. And I think, there is to be a little bit debated, because I think that some of the best times where Bernanke has been brought before Ron Paul, really, because if you listen to the other it was almost disgusting to hear the other Congress men and women talk to Bernanke, because they treat him with, I think, immense respect, and almost as if he is like, the guiding person there. Like, they had a representative from New York asking him, what are we going to do to help people pay back their home loans? Kind of a little bit like a religious, some religious overtones almost.
We were thinking
beyond
about the same
politeness.
Yeah, we were thinking about the same metaphor, because I was thinking of him. They were treating him sort of like a quasi deity, and that's pretty much where you're going with it. I mean, he's considered to be the god of the economy right now. They basically have decided that he's the one who rescued us from the abyss, and because of that, all is hunky dory in Bernanke land. So why give anybody a hard time about anything? That's really what it comes down to,
And the truth is, he actually not only has failed to solve the problem with the unemployment being still sky high, and with the inflation still being very high when you don't look at the government numbers, but. Or even actually, if you do look at some of the government numbers, I think that they do actually tell what's happening in fact. But I think that the underlying thing is the Fed actually caused this problem in the first place. So to get like kudos, even if he did solve it, which he hasn't, is a little bit just kind of highlights the economic ignorance of basic principles, economic principles, and finance that these people in Congress have. And one thing on Congressman Paul, he was obviously he went into, his question was on legalizing currencies, which Bernanke replied, you can buy gold, yen, euros, etc. But and Congressman Paul pointed out rightly that when you buy and sell gold or silver, you have to pay a collectibles tax on it. You have capital gains a lot of times. It's not really a fee. There's fees associated with it, but I think that it almost would have been better, because in the past some of his best times have been if he gives a real zinger to Bernanke and lets him try to answer it, and let Bernanke kind of string his own rope. But I think it was in kind of presidential campaign mode there.
Yeah, I think you're right. He definitely was. I mean, as you mentioned, this is in the context of the European bailout, which went through yesterday and today, and with those 800 banks receiving the funds. And in fact, Euroland right now is basically facing recession. And Gene DiNardo is now joining us. And Gene, I know you did a little digging into this. Not only are they going into a recession, but there's a very big potential for a deep recession, isn't there?
Well, yeah, and it's kind of varies with the countries, of course. But basically, the worse off the country, the debtor nations like Greece, et cetera, are the ones that are going to hit it. It's going to hit the worst. And I'll read a little bit from this article. Goes on to say, Europe's economies are still on divergent paths, with Italy and Spain dragging down the region as it faces a mild recession this year that could turn far worse, an official forecast said Thursday. That was last Thursday. Well, almost all countries face a slowdown. Differences remain pronounced. The report from the European Commission said, with the debt crisis most severe among those nations with poor public finances, weak banks, and a history of low growth, a cocktail common to several countries in southern Europe, and these are the same countries that are in trouble, or they're trying to get the creditor nations to give them more and more funds. The recession in Spain is so severe that it may be given more leeway over meeting budget goals laid down by the Commission, the European Union's executive branch. It goes on to say the Eurozone economy as a whole will probably shrink 0.3% in 2002. And last November, they had forecast a growth of a half a percent. The Eurozone's large core nations, Germany and France, are set to grow in 2012, but only 0.6% and 0.4% respectively. Pushing the projections down were a predicted contraction of 1.3% for Italy and 1% for Spain. Of the three small countries that have received international bailouts, Ireland was expected to experience slight growth, while Greece and Portugal were projected to suffer steep contractions. There was a 0.1% drop in employment during the third quarter in both the 27-country European Union and the 17 nations that use the euro, with the worst impact felt in the south. So it pretty much goes along the lines of, it's kind of interesting, if you're a creditor, you might do, you know, mediocre, and if you're a debtor nation in Europe, you're going to be seeing hard times, which is, I think we've talked about this before, but they're going to go into times that are actually worse than right now in the last few years, and yet they're expected to pay off these bigger and bigger loans. I just kind of wonder how they're going to do it.
Well, you say that the creditors are going to do so. Actually, I would say the creditors are doing great, simply because they made some very, very bad decisions investing in some sovereign debt paper that they should never have invested in. So what's their penalty? Well, they get rewarded.
They get bailed out.
The ECB.
And, of course, and their economies won't be hurt so much because the printed money is going to go back to them.
But it also raises a question. I mean, if you've got a recession hitting a number of different countries at a time where the ECB basically just inflated the money supply, this is what we talked about before, the potential for an inflationary recession. It has only happened once here in this country back in the late part of the 20th century, 1979, I think it was, but the potential still exists. We thought it might happen here in the U.S. It hasn't happened here yet, but that I can't rule that one out either. And I would say that over in Europe, the chances are at least a little bit better than they were yesterday when you look at what's happening with the combination of the bailout and on the other hand, the fact that they're in recession.
Yeah, I agree, and I don't think we're far from it here in the U.S. As far as we are, you know, like the reports are saying we're improving, and we're improving a little bit, so we're kind of avoiding the falling back into recession. But, you know, the inflation is obviously there. It wouldn't take much, really, to, we could really go either way with the economy right now. And if it goes into a recession, the prices could remain high because of the just the huge amount of monetary inflation that's gone on. And there's still demand in parts of the country, parts of the world that could push prices up here. So it's interesting.
And Jake, the fact that we are in this slight growth mode is really only based on the fact that you measure it against dollars. You measure it against precious metals. Like Gene was pointing out, we really are in a recession.
Oh, sure. I mean, as far as gold goes, everything's deflating really against gold. The buy shares in the Dow is deflating. To buy a house is deflating. I think over the past 10 years, I used to take somewhere around 400 ounces of gold to buy a house. Now it's about less than 100 to buy the same house. So your purchasing power, if you stored gold since then, in a home vault or in a bank, safe deposit box or depository, your purchasing power would have gone up by four, a factor of four. With the Dow, it's a factor of like six or seven. Really, you can do the same thing with gas or whatever. But even when you're looking at dollars, like if you go into even the relatively skewed numbers that come out of the BLS, sometimes the Bureau of Labor and Statistics, if you look at some of the mainstays like gasoline, unleaded, regular. If you go back a year, it was about $2.70 a gallon. Now the January price that they put up on the website was $3.40. So that's about close to 25%. And look at some of the other things, whether it's coffee or milk and all these other things, they are also showing very strong increases, which you know, you have to look at supply and demand, obviously, but I think in this case it's really just due to central banks with their money printing.
Absolutely true.
And that, yeah. Actually, Jake, I had a question for you, kind of about the mechanics of gold and silver, but I actually had to sell some silver. It wasn't ours, and I don't want to get into the story because it's too long. But the it was interesting because I was shopping around, and somebody told me, well, you should get 75% of the spot price. And so the spot price is basically, wouldn't that be the price that's normally quoted on the market price?
Well, yeah, theoretically the spot price is, you know, the difference or roughly between the bid and the ask price on the futures market for whatever it is there. But the funny thing about it is people use the spot price in order to sell things or to add like a markup onto it. But there really isn't any, you know, specific spot. Like, it's not like it's an actual, you know, a market where people are buying and selling things. But for something like silver, it depends what form the silver's in. Like if you have like old silver coins or something like that, if you're selling it at this point in time, you might get a little bit below spot, which is $35.50 an ounce. But if you have like American Eagle silver bullion coins or something like that, even if you're reselling them, you should be getting about a dollar or two premium on top of whatever the spot price is. I would say that 75% of spot price, you're just going to one of those places that are ripping you off. And
well, actually, those guys are at 50%. But this was you know, silverware like teapots and stuff like that.
That might be different. Yeah,
they said that it also it's weighted, and these guys were the reputable guys, I guess, were at 75% for this. But it was just kind of interesting, the mechanics. You know, I was kind of curious about it.
Well, there's no doubt about it. It's a challenging market because it's such a narrow market, and a lot of people don't participate in it. So it becomes even more difficult when you don't know the mechanics of it. No doubt about that. Of course, all this about the precious metals and the monetary system basically tie into virtually every level of society, including what governments do with and between each other. And of course, that leads to foreign policy and military type issues and wars and that kind of thing. There's a lot of that going on this week. Let's go first to what's been happening over in North Korea. For those who didn't hear, North Korea is supposedly announcing that they're willing to let inspectors in to inspect their nuclear program. That's a first, supposedly, that they're actually going to let people in. I have my doubts whether they're really going to let people in, but we shall see about that. And, Jake, I believe you have some interesting details about how that could play out where food aid is concerned.
Yeah, the State Department has reported that North Korea is going to halt its nuclear activities, which who knows what the heck they were doing, in exchange for 240,000 metric tons of food aid from the United States. The people there, you know, people ultimately vote, or in North Korea's case, they don't vote, but they still suffer with their stomachs, and the situation there has probably gotten so bad. The LA Times article that I'm reading is saying that North Koreans are still reeling from a particularly bad year in 2011. Potato and barley fields were frozen during a harsh winter in late 2010, and then they had flooding last summer to destroy the fields and corn. The number of children admitted to North Korean hospitals for malnutrition has doubled. And the UN is stating that even this amount of grain is not going to be enough to save the country. However, you know, and it's interesting to see how this is kind of playing out with Iran, because Iran, of course, is kind of in a similar boat, except there's an embargo, so they're actually starving because of the outside world. Whereas Korea really always, like for a very, very, very long time, has had harsh winters, mainly because it's tough to grow stuff in the soil that they have there, which has been farmed out for, you know, centuries by the Korean people. Like if you go into Korea, one of the interesting things, like if you go to China or something like that, you get chopsticks. You get, you know, typically wooden chopsticks or something like that. But in Korea, they don't want to waste the wood, so people's chopsticks are usually made out of metal, and because that's one of their one of the things that they can kind of export from their country in exchange for food. So the country, a totalitarian regime such as North Korea, they don't really have a shot at, you know, even making enough food for themselves, which really kind of outlines why this, you know, lack of democracy, but also lack of rule of law and dictatorship just does not result in very good results. They're really living in the medieval ages. But some conjecture on my part with Iran is that, you know, if we had real talks with Iran or something, and they, and you know, in this case, the international world is actually causing the all the you know, they don't have a humanitarian crisis there, but they will if they keep this going on, and you know, something like that could easily kind of result in a win for both sides.
Well, there may not be any known human casualties, widespread hunger and so forth in Iran, but that's just partially because it's a closed society. I mean, we don't know a whole lot about what's going on. We do know that the inflation's been high. We do know that money, real money, is scarce, and bad money is readily available but useless. Something else that we also know, you mentioned Iran, it cued my mind, an article I saw that came out of Reuters today. It was a poll that was done in Israel. A wide majority of Israelis either oppose an Israeli strike on Iran or would favor an attack only if it was carried out with U.S. agreement. That, according to an opinion poll that was released on Thursday, the survey was by the University of Maryland and the Israeli Dahaf Institute, and was released before talks next week between Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and U.S. President Barack Obama on Iran's nuclear program. The poll found that 34% of the 500 people surveyed believed that Israel should not strike Iran, and 42% said it should attack only if the U.S. backed the decision. Only 19% believed Israel should attack even without the support of Washington, which said on Wednesday that diplomacy and increased sanctions to curb Iran's nuclear ambitions have time to work. Very interesting timing on this, particularly, as you say, in light of what's happening with North Korea, because it, I would think it would have a positive effect on Iran. It would suggest to them that, first of all, they can hold their own, their hardline position that they've been trying to hold, and second of all, they can perhaps feel like they have some bargaining chips, because it looks like the Israeli people aren't really as hawkish as the media have been trying to tell us and as our American politicians have been trying to tell us.
Yeah, I think that's a great poll. I mean, it just goes to show that governments do not listen to their people and really are not, you know, representative of their people. And I think this is true of virtually every country in the world. You know, we face this too, where people get an opinion of us in Europe and different countries, of negative opinion of our citizens, when it's our country that's actually not our country, but it's our government that's going around bombing countries at will. And you know, I think it's true. You know, it's funny because I've always been under the impression that these Israeli people were somewhat hawkish, but, you know, that poll just goes to show they're just normal people that want peace.
And on the flip side of it, when you look at the strong role that the hawks play here in the U.S., particularly within the political circles, within the media, Pentagon, and so on and so forth, it's really quite striking when you compare to what happens around the world, both in the media and in terms of polls and so on and so forth. There's a definite disconnect going on there. And in fact, I think you were finding through an article, you found that the role that Pentagon has on our entertainment culture is actually quite strong, isn't it?
Yeah, this was great. I was really surprised by this. First of all, it was written by David Sirota, who's a liberal commentator. But you know, you always correlate Hollywood with liberalness, and you know, you wouldn't correlate it with the Pentagon. But he did some research, and what he said, I'll kind of read from it. Since 1986, Top Gun rekindled the Pentagon-Hollywood relationship from its post-Vietnam doldrums. The collusion between the military and the entertainment industry has become a blockbuster, generating huge benefits for both participants and swindling the American public in the process. The scheme is simple. The Pentagon allows studios to use military hardware and bases at a discounted taxpayer-subsidized rate. In exchange, filmmakers must submit their scripts to the Pentagon for line edits. Not surprisingly, those edits often redact criticism of military policy, revised depictions of historical failures, and generally omit anything else that might make audiences wonder whether our current defense policy is repeating past mistakes. If a studio doesn't agree to the edits, then it loses access to the Marshall equipment, and typically the film is terminated. If, by contrast, the filmmakers agree to the edits, access is granted, and the film gets made at a cut-rate price to the studio. Except in the credits fine print, the audience is never told about censorship. The predictable results is a glut of movies that both celebrate U.S. military policy and whitewash the checkered history of military adventurism, and relatively few major movies questioning that policy and that adventurism. No doubt is a system of stealth coercion. The arrangement has been wildly effective. He goes on, and he talks about X-Men First Class and casting active duty SEALs. The film is ostensibly about a mission to neutralize terrorists, but as one of the filmmakers let slip this week, its heroic portrayals and triumphs are really designed to once again make us forget the past. So it's a great point, and it's something, you know, you kind of wonder if you ever see these films, how the sets are so real. That's because they are real. And, you know, it's interesting that they have a collusion here, and what comes out of it is all these movies, you know, you get millions of people seeing these movies that are pro-war, and you kind of wonder how people's opinions are changed, and that's obviously how they are. And I think it's a great or a terrible waste of taxpayers' funds, too. It's just...
Yeah, no doubt about that. And, of course, as we were saying, on the flip side, when you look at the way people overseas feel about militarism and the role that the U.S. has played and the allies of the U.S. have played in interfering all over the globe, it has become... It's quite the opposite of what we're hearing and what we're seeing out of the media and out of Hollywood. And there's actually a good example of that, isn't there, Jake, over in Afghanistan right now, because there's a real controversy going on there, a controversy that's led to destruction and rioting and all kinds of stuff, and it doesn't show any signs of letting up.
Right, and the Islamic holy books were burned, reportedly by mistake, by the U.S. military, and which of course is a major no-no in the Islamic religion, a major sign of disrespect. And even though there was apologies all around, even coming from President Obama, this has led to an outbreak of attacks against U.S. troops. Another two soldiers were shot dead today in Afghanistan, when three assailants, two of whom were believed Afghan soldiers, turned their weapons against American troops on Thursday. And this is kind of what we've been finding, is that this is not the first time it's been happening. There's either militants that are disguised in uniforms, or they are just the troops themselves that, for whatever reason, decide to revolt against the Americans or the foreigners, really, because European soldiers have been killed as well as part of NATO. A third U.S. service member was wounded in the attack but was not killed. U.S. forces responded with gunfire, and they killed both assailants. The third Afghan shooter in civilian clothing was wounded. He was identified as a teacher and is now in custody, military custody. So, another tragedy, and, you know, again, you just have to keep asking yourself, you know, why are we there overseas? And it just kind of reiterates that when you bomb a country and when you forcibly occupy it, regardless of what the media tells the American people, you know, we're not really wanted there by, you know, the Afghan people. And who can blame them? You know, we come in there, we bomb their country, we install martial law. It's no way to live, and we'd be the same way if we were treated that way by another country ourselves.
Very true. Well, we're coming up on the halfway mark here of the program, so let's take a break. And then after the break, we're going to explore some other non-financial, non-military issues, including the possibilities of a brokered GOP convention. We're going to look at the WikiLeaks release of the Stratfor emails. We're going to look at how healthcare dollars are being spent in this country. And Jake also has a very interesting article about a piano teacher who made a difference in Pennsylvania. Stay tuned for that. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back.
Run, run, run.
are back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. And just a reminder, you can always check out the latest and greatest about our program at our website, www.freedomnewshour.com. Also, you might want to check out the network's new website. They have done an overhaul, given it a completely different look at prn.fm. Check it out. It's quite a different look, and it's definitely going to be the look that's going to take us into the next round of growth for the network, no doubt about that. Meanwhile, as we were talking about before the break, a number of things are happening here domestically, particularly with the Republican race for the Republican nomination. It has, of course, been jockeying back and forth with both Mitt Romney leading most of the way lately. Rick Santorum kind of pulled in front, but now Romney has retaken his original position as number one. But there are all kinds of possibilities for how this is going to play out. It's not a sure thing that he's going to win it. And, Jake, there are actually possibilities of a brokered convention, aren't there?
Yeah, and they're kind of getting stronger every day. Like the media kind of rallied behind because Romney was able to win the Arizona and Michigan primaries, but at least in the Michigan primary, it appears that he'll get 16 delegates while Santorum will get 14. So almost a 50-50 split there. And, of course, in other states, both Newt Gingrich and Ron Paul have also been able to gather delegates. So I would say that the chances of this kind of going to a brokered convention, since one of the candidates, or Romney in this case, who has the lead, would need 1,144 delegates in order to not have a brokered convention, because he would already have over 50%. But the way things are kind of going right now, with Romney collecting fewer than 50%, it's probably like a 50-50 type deal, and I think that this is going to work itself out over the next few weeks. The Super Tuesday next week, where 419 delegates are at stake in 10 states, I think that's going to kind of settle the question a little bit more. This is not possibly the best thing for the Republican Party itself. The head honchos in the party, the last thing that they want to see is a brokered convention, because it means that they can't gather behind the main candidate, and Obama will remain relatively unscathed until after the convention, which I believe is usually it's somewhere around August, but I forget the exact date. And what's very also kind of interesting, Miss Shedlock, who we had on our show, I guess a few months ago or last year at some point, he gave a post on his website, globaleconomicanalysis.blogspot.com, about roughly the projections using the current polls favorable really towards Romney. And what it comes out is that it really doesn't look like he's going to have enough. Like after Super Tuesday, it looks like Romney will have about 359 delegates, or less than half of what's necessary. So it kind of does look like it would be like a 50-50 type deal. The estimate that he has is for Super Tuesday, if everything kind of holds together, which it won't, but 359 delegates for Romney, 202 for Santorum, 104 for Newt Gingrich, and 72 delegates for Ron Paul, which kind of looks fairly realistic from where I'm sitting. Of course, on our show, out of these four candidates, I think pretty much the only one that agrees with us on foreign policy and monetary policy is Ron Paul. And he's been talking as if he's been able to collect a lot more delegates than just that. But a lot of these delegates really aren't decided until the state has its convention. So it's kind of premature at this point. But it really does look like it will go towards a broker convention. I'd say probably the odds are a little bit better than 50% at this point. And if you look back to the 2008 race where Romney lost pretty handily, and John McCain kind of rose out of nowhere to take the nomination. It made things quite a bit easier for McCain. But in this case, a broker convention, again, the Republican Party would have to uh, kind of duke it out, and there would be the opportunity for Gingrich, Paul, and possibly Santorum to either make deals or get certain things into the platform that they want to see enacted in a Republican presidential race.
Mm-hmm.
And do they normally throw all their delegates towards, let's say they want it, talking to Romney, they were going to throw their delegates that way. Is it the candidate that controls the delegates, or do they control themselves? How does that usually work?
Well, each state has different rules. It's kind of similar to the Electoral College in that each state gets to decide how many, gets to decide which delegates are going. Some of them are decided by votes of the delegates that have been elected on the county level. Some delegates are actually the Republican chairs of the party themselves. Like here, I'm from Pennsylvania. There will be roughly 150 delegates sent to Harrisburg for a convention. At the convention, they will decide which, I think it's 10 delegates to send to D.C., but 3 out of the 10 are the Republican chair, vice chair, and some other position. So really, the party, is pretty much all establishment, gets 3 out of the 10 seats at the national convention, and the other 7 are chosen by just voting. So it's a very but each state is different. There's some states that are winner take all states where the delegates are what they call bound to the candidate. So for instance, in Arizona, which just had its primary, Romney got all 29 delegates. But the way this usually works is, so on the first vote, all 29 are supposed to. They don't have to vote for Romney, but they've signed with the party and that they will. But usually what happens is after that first round of voting, so if Romney does not get to 50%, after the first round of voting, the delegates are all unbound and can vote for whoever they want. So that's also the interesting part. Is sometimes the campaigns might be able to get their people in, but they just can't vote for, or they're not supposed to vote for the candidate that they were originally put in for until after the first round of voting.
It's interesting you mentioned that, too, because I can't remember which Western state it was. It may have been Nevada, may even have been Utah. I think it might have been Nevada, but I saw a news report in which they mentioned that of the various delegates to the state convention, for that particular state, half of them were Ron Paul supporters. Now, Ron Paul did not win Nevada, but the Paul campaign has been extraordinarily active in all the states where it's not a winner-take-all situation, in getting their own people directly involved in the political process that actually gets involved in naming delegates to the national convention. So we could see a very peculiar situation where, for instance, a number of Ron Paul supporters are pledged to support another candidate, but when you have the broker convention situation come around, assuming that Romney doesn't get the 50% he needs to be nominated, then they become available to vote for Ron Paul.
Yeah, no, it's like here in Pennsylvania, and I don't know how it is in other states because each state is different, but it's a little bit tricky because the straw poll for the candidates here in Pennsylvania actually means nothing. It's just for the media, really, and I guess public relations and PR, but there's delegates that are listed on the ballot, and the very tricky thing is that it doesn't say, you'll be voting for someone, but it's not going to tell you which candidate they support. So it's very important to get people on there. And even then, like, when people walk into the voting booths, probably well over 50% are going to have no idea which delegate to vote for. So, of course, the Ron Paul folks are going to know exactly who to vote for.
Yeah,
oh, of course.
They won't have any choice or any doubt there. You know, it's also kind of an indication of the impact of the Tea Party as what's happening in the Republican Party. I would think in years past, Romney would be a sure in, you know, as far as having the party backing and everything. But with the Tea Party element, you know, they're kind of made a lot of interesting factors have entered. And Santorum's the latest one.
he's the latest one. The question is, how long is he going to remain the latest one? Because there are a number of states where he can't even compete, which is really kind of weird.
Yeah, he's a bit low on funds compared to.
Plus, I mean, here in Virginia, he's not even on the ballot. So.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. The only two candidates on the ballot in Virginia are going to be Ron Paul and Mitt Romney. Gingrich and Santorum didn't get the sufficient signature count in, so they're not there.
Organization.
Oh, yes. And we covered that a few weeks ago, actually. Of course, all of this ties into what happens when people actually get elected, because that's the whole point of having a presidential election, and not just presidential, congressional and senatorial as well. And it also plays a role in terms of what happens with various issues. That's why, of course, issues become a major part of the electoral cycle. One of the big issues in this election cycle is likely to continue to be health care. It was not really resolved by the election of 2008 or Obama's health care initiative passed in 2009. And it's becoming an increasingly divisive issue, if that's at all possible, as if it wasn't divisive enough because of the way those health care dollars are spent. Gene, I know you have some very fascinating details about that.
Yeah, this is a good, it's kind of self-evident, but this was a good thing. This came from PolitiFact, and it's actually a local, had local origins, but it applies to the national scene and really the world scene as far as health care. But there was a local senator from the Oregon Senate, Alan Bates, and he basically said 80% of the health care dollars are spent by 20% of the population. He was talking about keying in on these people who absorb most of the money and trying to organize it more. And he went on to say, we spend twice as much money per person in the U.S. than any industrialized country, and yet we have the worst outcomes. Our health care system is literally awash in dollars. And then he came up with the 80% thing. So PolitiFact was researching this and seeing if it's actually true. First, they gave Bates' office a call. An aide there said the 80-20 split was general knowledge, which doesn't mean much, and that the senator heard it recently from the director of the Oregon Health Authority. That led us to the health authority spokesman, Karen Fish, who pointed us, she agreed and pointed them to two sources. The first was an Oregonian article by Bill Graves. It was about this topic. In his story, Graves notes that at Care Oregon, a Portland-managed care organization for Oregon Health Plan, about 25% of the adult patients accounted for 83% of the spending, and that was in 2011. That number seemed to reflect the same general principle Bates had mentioned. Deborah Reed is a senior evaluation associate with Care Oregon. She said that the reason for the high cost of HUE comes down to hospital visits, where most people wind up when they're having a chronic condition or in the last stages of terminal illness. And I quote here, when you look at healthcare costs overall, the hospital is the thing that costs the most, vastly costs the most. So it's basically driven by hospital costs. The sicker you are, the more likely you are to go to the hospital. And an interesting side article I read a few years ago was a study on the price of hospital rooms, and the logic in the article, and it was really good logic, was that, you know, the room is just a room. And the guy was comparing it, the writer was comparing it to hotel rooms in whatever city it was done. The hotel rooms were running about $150. The hospital rooms were running $900. He was like, why is this happening? You know, and that, you know, they charge for everything. So it's basically, that's just the charge for the room. And it's just ridiculous. But anyway, to go on, the second source they used was a chart from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Agency. The chart showed exactly what Bates said. 20% of the population accounts for 80% of the total expenditures. Maybe even more shockingly, the chart also shows that just 5% of the population accounts for 50% of the expenditures. Let's see. And then Stephanie Burnell, who's with the Oregon State University Health Management Policy, she said the 80-20 split was a very reasonable thing for somebody to say. She goes on to say it was even more interesting whittling down that 20%, noting again that just 5% account for 49%. I think the stories are more interesting when you get into who's in that 20%. And then it goes on to, it's obvious that people consume the most health care at the beginning and the end of life. Births are expensive, and so is the latter part of life when chronic conditions start to creep up and catch up with people. So it's kind of an obvious thing, but it's interesting that there's so much of the cost to so few of the population, and I don't think it really solves anything, but it's a good observation.
It's a very difficult issue because it has so many different aspects to it. The one aspect I keep looking for, and perhaps I'm optimistic to look for it, but I keep looking for it anyway, is for someone to realize the role that the monetary system plays in it. Now, I know here on the Freedom News Hour, we've talked about it a lot. I've made a particular point to talk about it, not just where healthcare is concerned, and we've all talked about where, you know, the military is concerned and foreign policy is concerned, and a whole range of issues are concerned. But I look at it particularly in healthcare because I look at how much money has been poured into healthcare, especially over the last, 10 to 15 years, something like that. You can even go back roughly to around the late 1970s, early 1980s, and track along that period. And it's just this huge swooping up graph when you look at the amount of money that's been poured into healthcare. The thing that I keep coming back to is, well, that money has to come from somewhere. It's not like we all have huge amounts of disposable income that just keep pouring into our laps so we can keep spending this money on healthcare. So where does it come from? And ultimately, it comes from what Jake was talking about earlier, all the new money being created most recently by the European Central Bank, but over the last few years particularly by the Federal Reserve System.
Well, that is completely ignored. As much as we obsess with it, it's ignored as far as healthcare. I've never heard that other than when you said it. And you know, the funny thing about the fiat money and printing, when they print money, is it does go somewhere, but it doesn't go everywhere. I mean, the stock market's a good example. I read an article the other day how reaching 13,000 doesn't mean much when you have, you know, all these woes in the economy. And the money kind of, you know, the money that's produced by the government, by the Federal Reserve, it's kind of like seeks certain markets, and I think, you know, that's a great point. The healthcare is one of them. It's not the only problem in healthcare, but it's definitely a major problem.
And it's completely overlooked as far as I'm concerned. I mean, you're right. Nobody mentions it. Nobody even talks about it. It's a non-event for any of the politicos, for any of the talking heads on TV. I mean, there is no connection whatsoever. And yet, to borrow the much overused phrase, it's the elephant in the room. It's the one that nobody wants to look at.
Yeah, the money wasn't there. They couldn't ask for it. They couldn't get it. I mean, they're not asking for it. They're getting it. So
right. I mean, part of that $900 per room thing is due to the way the healthcare is structured. I mean, frankly, the fact that hospitals are required by law to treat anybody, regardless of whether they have any health insurance, coming in on any kind of situation, and to treat them in the emergency room, well, of course you're going to end up with $900 hospital rooms. You're going to end up with a lot of ridiculously high costs, particularly where emergency is concerned. I mean, I have an associate who went in for, he slipped on the ice, I think it was, about a year and a half ago, year and a quarter ago, and fell, went into the emergency room. They did an MRI. He got the bill later, and the visit to the emergency room cost him over $20,000.
God.
Wow. $20,000.
It's really absurd.
He could have bought the darn MRI machine.
How much do those things cost?
Well, maybe not quite, but...
Yeah, you just can't, you know, go out and open a hospital. It's just, the amount of regulation and restriction is just phenomenal. And you know, of course, that means, you know, if you do have a hospital, if you're able to jump through those hoops, you can ask what you want. So,
I suppose that's true. But what happens when you live in what used to be a republic that was constitutionally based, and where the Constitution basically got thrown out the window, and so we're living with the consequences of it. Although there are times when people are actually able to fight back and defend the Constitution, and Jake has a very interesting story about that. What are the details of how one particular person fought back, Jake?
Yes, a local woman from Allentown decided that, or she wondered several years ago, why if she took a walk, she would go from one congressional district to another. And when she looked into it, she saw these crazy cookie-cutter designs on the state map of Pennsylvania for the state legislature and for the federal Congress, and kind of got curious as to how they are decided. And, of course, that's what we call gerrymandering, where the whatever party in power gets to try to cement its elections by changing the districts and the boundaries and results in all these crazy combinations. Well, her name was Amanda Holt, and she went starting last year when this board went around to each community to hear people's opinions. She spoke up and spent over 100 hours on a plan that when you look at it, you're like, oh, it makes sense, because under the Pennsylvania state constitution, gerrymandering is actually prohibited. It says that as long as basically you cannot divide up communities or towns or cities unless it's like completely impossible. So she went through the legalistic arguments for each one and decided that the current map that they had in place from the 2000 census really was insane. And then the Republican Party controlled the votes and came out with this completely gerrymandered map of all of Pennsylvania, whether it was for the state legislature, the state senate, or the federal Congress, which guarantees a Republican majority everywhere, even though the state is a little bit of a swing state in terms of Democrats, and they did vote for Obama in the last election. And this was decided, and she decided to not quit, and she took part with a bunch of other parties to challenge the new redistricting, and it's gone to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, which, you know, we have kind of low confidence in a lot of these court systems, but the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled that she was correct and that she had given compelling evidence that the Republican Party and, you know, whatever Democrats voted for as well acted unconstitutionally, and that they have an obligation to draw a new map. So it kind of puts a lot of things into chaos, like the primaries are in April, and not everyone's completely sure of where the boundaries are, and they're still kind of trying to decide if the boundaries will change after this election cycle or what have you. But I think it's a great story of a piano teacher kind of taking on the system by herself, really, and winning.
It's an astonishing story when you think about
it.
And the fact that, if I understand this correctly, she actually created her own version of the districting plan, and she did it with, like, some software that she bought for a couple $100.
Right, right. Because all you really need to know is the populations of all the voting areas. Like, in Pennsylvania, it's boroughs, townships, or cities. And she just sliced it up, and you look at it, and you're like, you know, it's not so bad. And she kept, she did exactly what the Pennsylvania Constitution says, which is to keep these areas together. And, you know, it just kind of brings out the utter hypocrisy, because these legislatures, in addition to getting paid, they, you know, paraded around the entire state listening to people. At the end of the day, they just went behind closed doors and did what the Republicans wanted, which was, you know, the majority in the House and the Senate here in the state. That's why the Republicans are in charge. And again, I'm not taking any sides. If the Democrats were in charge, it would just be gerrymandered for the Democrats. So what she did, I think, is a great thing, and it just highlights that sometimes if you take on the system, you will win.
And she was a piano teacher, which just goes to show that musicians aren't all bad.
No, not at all.
I can say that. I'm a musician. So.
I think we'll just be very careful and leave it right there. Well, unfortunately, we're running out of time. We're not going to be able to get to the WikiLeaks article, although I thought that was a really fascinating release that they made. But maybe we'll pick that up again next week. But Jake and Gene, as usual, it's been a pleasure.
Good show. Good job, you guys.
We will see you all next week here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.
Finally.